My friends, welcome to the weekend interview show for Saturday, June the 18th, 2005. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. If anybody wants to check out the archives, got about, I think, 84, 85 archives up there in MP3 format of previous interviews. If anybody ever wants to contact me, my email is scott@weekendinterviewshow.com or scott@antiwar.com. And we're going to be talking economics today. Oh, but don't switch your channel yet, because we're not talking Laffer Curves and M1 supplies. We're talking about the economics of terrorism in the first hour. And in the second hour, Mises Institute economist by the name of Bob Murphy will be discussing market anarchism. So this is going to be a very interesting show about economics. My first guest is Loretta Napoleoni. She's an economist and an expert on international terrorism who writes for Italy's financial papers. She's the author of Dossier Baghdad, the forthcoming Insurgent Iraq about Zarqawi, and Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. It's an honor to have you on. This is a very impressive investigation you have here in this book, ma'am.
Well, thank you. Yes, it took 10 years to do that.
10 years, really. Well, I hope you don't mind too much if we disagree about a few things.
Sure.
Beginning with the idea, and you basically get this across right at the beginning of your book, of terrorism as an act of war rather than a crime, and that treating it as a crime is not sufficient. It must be treated as an act of war. So I guess before I attempt to contradict you, give you a chance to explain your point of view there.
Well, actually, what I say in my book is that until September 11, terrorism was considered and was treated as a crime. This is the way that, for example, the British dealt with the IRA or the Italians with the Red Brigades. After 9/11, terrorism became a threat to national security, so it was considered an act of war, and that's what George Bush did, starting with the concept of the war on terror. The truth is that terrorism is a crime with war aims, and this is the real problem that poses to modern societies, which is actually how to deal with it. Shall we deal as a crime or shall we deal as a war? And none of these two alternatives actually works, because it's not a crime and it's not an act of war. So that's the dilemma that terrorists produces.
There is the problem of you can't really deter people with criminal action if they're willing to strap themselves with explosives. You know, prosecution isn't really a very big threat.
Well, but that's exactly the definition that I was giving you before. A crime, because it is a crime to kill innocent people, non-combatants, which is what a suicide bomber does. But a suicide bomber does not kill for the pleasure of killing, or does not kill because he wants to steal money, for example. He actually kills because he's engaged in what he considers a war. So his actions are actually motivated by his desire to move war against his enemy. So that's the dilemma, basically, that we're all facing.
Right. Well, and the reason that this matters so much, why we want to parse this definition and split this hair, is because it's really about who has the responsibility for dealing with the problem. If it's a crime, then it's to be dealt with through the FBI and Interpol and court systems and where people have a Bill of Rights and that kind of thing. If it's a war, then we should send the Marine Corps to go blast them all to hell. So that's really what it comes down to. I would posit, and I don't say this in any way to contradict anything you wrote in your book or anything, but I don't think that the cops, at least in America, ever really got a chance to attempt to treat it as a law enforcement problem. But we'll discuss that more when we get back from this break. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be right back. right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Loretta Napoleone. She's the author of Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. It's an incredible book. It's really about the privatization of terrorism. Mrs. Napoleone, in your book, you write about how most of the original terrorist movements of the 20th century, post-World War II, really grew up in opposition, well, some sponsored by, I suppose, but also they were indigenous movements that grew up against the colonialism of the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War. Is that right?
Yes. What I discover in my book is that by retracing the birth and evolution of arms organization, basically following the money, the model that has been used through this evolution has always been the same, which is the model of the state sponsor of terrorism, which you all remember was a feature of the Cold War, and when the two superpowers were fighting war by proxy by fully funding armed organization. Perhaps the best example for the American audience is the Contras in Nicaragua, which were created by the CIA. They were funded legally by the U.S. Congress and illegally by the Reagan administration. Now, that model, if you look at all the other groups through the various evolution, privatization in the 1970s, globalization in the 1990s, it's always been in place. And that's the model also of Al-Qaeda.
What is the shell state model?
Well, the shell state is a state that only has the outside of a state. So it has the social, economic infrastructure of a state, but lacks the core, which is the national identity, the right of self-determination, the willingness of the population to be part of this state. The shell state is a byproduct of the privatization of terrorism, which took place in the 1970s, when some groups managed to gain independence from the sponsor and they started to self-fund themselves. The formation of the shell state, it's always the same, and we see today in Iraq, again, the same pattern. An armed organization moved into an area, gained control, militarily speaking, and with force of this area, destroys the socio-economic infrastructure of the previous government and replaces it with its own socio-economic infrastructure, which is based upon the maintenance of the war or the armed struggle.
And some more examples of this that you cite in the book would be Hamas and Hezbollah, where they don't really have a legitimate state, and yet they do carry out many state-like functions in the occupied territories.
Yes. A shell state can be as small as a section of a town. Now, Fallujah was a very interesting example of several shell states present within the same city. So we had the Al-Zarqawi group, which controlled a certain section of the town, but then we had the Baath loyalists, which controlled other section of the town, and then we had the Islamo-nationalists and the residents of Fallujah, which controlled a third section. So a shell state can actually be very, very small or very big. The Afghanistan of the Taliban was an example of shell state also.
And also, you say in your book that one of the major characteristics of these shell states is that because of the breakdown of basically all real infrastructure, they become economies strictly of warfare, where the only way that somebody can make a few hundred bucks is by joining the private army.
Yes, well, that's exactly the danger. I think it's the most important danger of the shell state, is the fact that the economy of the armed organization is based 100% upon the maintenance of war or of the armed struggle. So any form of transition from this form of economy into a traditional economy is impossible. And we don't have one single example of a shell state which successfully developed into a real state. So the population is trapped inside these enclaves and is forced to become part of this economy because basically that's the only way they can survive.
And Well, actually, you know what? I kind of want to stop right here for a second and kind of get to the question of why terrorism works in the first place. What makes it a successful tactic?
Well, terrorism works because you use violence, and violence is very effective. Also, terrorism works because it terrorizes people, and by terrorizing people, you can magnify over and over what is your actual strength. I'll give you an example of al-Zarqawi. The myth of al-Zarqawi has been constructed around these legendary actions that the guy is supposed to have done. The truth is that this is just an image that is projected to the world in order to maintain an enemy, which is an evil enemy that is so evil that terrifies the people. But the truth is al-Zarqawi is not as strong as we believe he is. He doesn't control the insurgency in Iraq. He's very unpopular within the insurgency in Iraq. And yet, he is considered the most important terrorist that is present today in Iraq.
So really, it's all about the reaction, right? It's all about, well, I'm thinking of like old examples of the IRA would kidnap a British soldier and kill him and leave his body on the doorstep of the barracks in order to get the British Army to come and lash out and kill a bunch of Irishmen. And then the IRA would say, see what brutal killers they are? We've been trying to tell you. And they're kind of provoking that reaction. And in that sense, as you just described with Zarqawi, say, for example, he blows up a couple of truck bombs and he gets credit for 10. At the same time, as you described, America gets to have their boogeyman and they get to have their ally. So I'm reminded of Osama bin Laden's speech from last October where he says, isn't it funny how our interests and the interests of the Bush administration converge completely? Here we're trying to lure them into the Middle East and they want nothing better than to be lured into the Middle East. And so I guess it really comes down to if the terrorists, if this is all in their interests, and it's all apparently in the interest of the government. Is it just us getting pinched in the middle here?
Yes.
Us regular people?
Yes, I think we are the victims of both enemies. I think we are. The United States and the UK are pursuing a policy which is based upon projection of a nightmare scenario, which is reminiscent of 9/11. The truth is that the chances that another 9/11 is going to take place in the near future are very, very slim. For a start, Osama bin Laden is not free. I mean, he is virtually trapped inside the tribal belt in northern Pakistan, between Pakistan and Afghanistan. He doesn't have the camps where he trained the people that actually did the 9/11. He doesn't have the brains that put 9/11 in place. I mean, the situation has changed radically. I mean, terrorists today is less of a threat than he was before 9/11. But yet, what the UK and the US government want us to believe is that, no, it is actually a bigger threat, so that they can pursue policy, which are reactionary policies, so that they can get consensus to pursue this policy. In the United Kingdom, for example, they abolished the habeas corpus, which was introduced several centuries ago, and it was the base of a true legal system in this country. And they abolished it on the basis that the threat of terrorism is so big that we cannot possibly maintain the legislation as it was before. Now, the IRA was 10 times more dangerous than Osama bin Laden in the United Kingdom, and they never abolished the habeas corpus.
And as you point out, the great writ habeas corpus, meaning where's the body, that's the right of the judge to demand that the executive branch explain why they're holding someone. That is the very basis of all Anglo-American liberty in our legal traditions.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is the foundation of the modern legal system. Without that, anybody, and this is what is happening in the United Kingdom, anybody can be imprisoned without a reason by the executive power. And this is what is happening today.
Well, and I think this is probably part of the strategy of the terrorists, too, is to, when something catches on fire, or, you know, something like September 11th happens, 3,000 people die, the reaction of the American people is government, protect us, in order to protect us, even if they were unwilling, which obviously they're very willing, but even if they were unwilling, they have to clamp down on our rights, they have to peek into our bank accounts, they have to do all these things in order to protect us, and in the end, Bin Laden is successfully turning us against our own government, which is really his enemy, right? And
yes.
Since he can't destroy our government, he's trying to get us to hate it enough to destroy it for him.
Yes, I think what you're saying is very, very true, because Osama bin Laden or al-Zarqawi or any of these people cannot destroy our society. We're too strong. Our democracies are too solid. We are a real state. Meaning we're not a shell state, so we have the socio-economic infrastructure, but also we have the willingness, the conviction to be part of this state. So that's very strong, and no Osama bin Laden can destroy. But we, ourselves, our leaders, from inside this system, yes, we can destroy ourselves. And that would be the greatest victory of Osama bin Laden.
I'm talking with Loretta Napoleoni, author of Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. We'll be right back.
Son, leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Loretta Napoleoni. She's an Italian journalist who is the author of Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks, an incredible investigative work. I got to really hand it to you, Mrs. Napoleoni. It is really great.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence.
The ISI.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, it is a sort of a power within Pakistan. The ISI was instrumental in channeling the money from the CIA and the Saudis to the Mujahideen during the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan in the 1980s. It was also instrumental in stealing a lot of money and a lot of arms and ammunition, which after the war ended were used to fund and to arm various Islamic armed organizations, for example in Kashmir, but also in Punjab, all the way down to Indonesia and Southeast Asia. The ISI was also involved in sponsoring the Taliban and in backing the Taliban in power. And finally, today, I have information that the ISI is the one that knows where Osama bin Laden is, and to a certain extent is the organization is keeping Osama bin Laden prisoner in the region where he is, which is against the tribal belt in at the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
What was the purpose of, well, you say in your book, just now you mentioned a few, but you say in your book that basically when the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan was over, that the ISI basically sent these Mujahideen holy warriors all over Asia, not just, really everywhere from Algeria, Northern Africa, all the way through the five stands, the former Soviet republics, Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. What was the purpose of the ISI exporting these jihadists to all these different places?
Well, Pakistan wanted to create a sort of hegemonic power in South Asia, which stretched all the way across the Caucasus up to the Balkans. It didn't want really to colonize this region. It wanted to be the major player economically and politically. And to do that, he used the Mujahideen, which basically were going to open up the road for Pakistani businessman and politician in order to exercise this hegemonic power.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Your phone cut out a little bit there. Can you repeat just that last sentence?
I said, you know, they use the Mujahideen to open up the road into these countries so that Pakistani businessmen and politicians could exercise their hegemony in these countries. These kind of plan, to a certain extent, clashed with the plan of the Saudis, who also had a similar idea. They wanted to colonize, but not only economically, but also religiously, the Wahhabis we're talking about, the very radical Islamists from Saudi Arabia. They wanted to colonize the same region. Now, in the end, the Saudis managed to achieve a larger portion of this region. And we must say that the majority of the countries that they were targeted, they were countries that belonged to the former Soviet Union, where there was a majority of Muslim, and these Muslims during the communist regime had been prevented from professing their religion, from basically, you know, following Islam.
Did the Americans encourage the Pakistanis to export this jihad to the former Soviet Union, particularly?
Well, the Americans knew, in particular the CIA, they knew exactly what was happening, as they also knew what was happening with the nuclear plan. The Saudis, in fact, funded part of the plan, and in the end, the Saudis paid the fine, which was imposed upon Pakistan for building the nuclear weapon. So the Americans knew, but they did not intervene. And this is for many reasons, but the most important reasons are, first of all, the fact that they thought that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the enemy was gone, that there was not going to be another enemy, that America had won the Cold War and was going to be the superpower forever and ever. Secondly, they did not want to upset the Pakistani, in particular the ISI, because they had been allied for a long time, and the Pakistanis knew many stories about the way that the Cold War was fought. And thirdly, they did not, especially after 1978 with the fall of Iran, they absolutely did not want to contrast the policy of Saudi Arabia. So these three main factors are at the base of the fact that the U.S. did not intervene. And if the U.S. intervened, we would not have had the 9/11, of course.
All right, everybody. It's the weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Loretta Napoleoni. She's an Italian reporter. She's a novelist, and she's got a new book coming out called Insurgent Iraq about Zarqawi. And the one we're talking about right now is Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. And we'll be right back after this break. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Republic Broadcasting Network, and I'm talking to Loretta Napoleoni. Her book is Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. And you talk in your book about, particularly in reference to the five stands, I guess they call them there, in Central Asia, the former Soviet republics, Islamic countries there, and how when the Soviet Union fell apart, what had, interestingly enough, been sort of a free trade situation between these Soviet republics deteriorated because what had formerly been just sort of state borders within the Soviet Union became real international borders, complete with tariffs and regulations and restrictions on trade, and that the destruction of the economies by the tin pot dictators of these stands has really created a very fertile breeding ground for future terrorists.
Yeah, absolutely. This is exactly what happened in Central Asia. If you look at the Fergana Valley, for example, the Fergana Valley It was one of the most fertile valleys in the entire Central Asia.
That's in Uzbekistan, right?
It's at the border. I mean, it's in the middle. Now it's all in Uzbekistan, but part of it is in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. So the markets were completely cut off from the rest of the valley. People could not travel any longer. The water supply was completely diverted because this border, these artificial borders were constructed. This was the beginning of the impoverishment of the Fergana Valley. Now, what we've seen happening in Uzbekistan recently, in May, it all took place in the Fergana Valley, where we have over 75% unemployment. Most of this unemployment is among the young people. It's basically a great greenhouse for breeding terrorism, in particular Islamic terror organization. And also, this is the only form of opposition which has been in place inside these countries since the fall of the Soviet Union. Now, let's not forget that the leaders of the Central Asian republics, Karimov, for example, which is the leader of Uzbekistan, are former high-ranking Soviet officers. They were members of the Politburo. So you see there is also continuity within this new republic of the Soviet system, and people do not want that. People actually want a completely different regime.
And this is also the case in Kyrgyzstan as well, where they just had a color-coded revolution not too long ago deposing their former Soviet leader, right?
Yes, exactly. These are all free market revolutions. That's the truth.
Isn't that interesting? The story in Uzbekistan, of course, where Karimov, the American ally who boils people alive, murdered 1,000 people, according to the Scotsman, in the street, they actually, the battle was about the young people going to spring their bosses from jail, 23 businessmen that Karimov had locked up. They were going to spring their bosses so they could have their jobs back.
Yeah, exactly. The businessmen, they were in jail. They actually employed the majority of the people in the town. So this is why the town decided to demonstrate in their favor, because people wanted their job back. And one of the reasons why there was that strong upheaval is also because a series of legislation which has been introduced at the end of 2004, which are clearly in favor of the oligarchic elite, which is close to the political leadership, and against private enterprises. There are amazing stories, I mean, horrific stories. I mean, I was reading about a woman, a pensioner, that burned herself alive to demonstrate against a new legislation which prohibits people from having their own kitchen gardens. All the kitchen gardens have to be nationalized, so you can't have it. And this woman burned herself alive because that was the only way that she could survive through the winter, because she did not have enough money to actually sustain herself. So you see, there are also personal tragedies within this free market revolution. And George Bush, who is a free market man, according to what he's talking about.
According to what he says, anyway.
Well, exactly. It is a great contradiction that somebody like George Bush, who is constantly preaching about the free market economy, is actually allied himself with somebody who is repressing forces who are fighting for free market economy in Uzbekistan.
Absolutely. And further, you point out that when you have these countries that are such economic basket cases, I mean, Karimov, again, is the perfect example, a former communist with total, quote-unquote, protection that only makes his people suffer, that foreign people, particularly in the West, where there's lots of capital, they won't invest in Uzbekistan. There's no point in it, unless maybe they invest in something that's going to be immediately protected by government troops, some kind of thing like that. But as far as really getting these economies going, no one will invest there except Islamic charities and would-be terrorist groups and organizations like that. They fill the vacuum where the American capital stays out, right?
Yeah, well, you're not going to have, in a situation like Uzbekistan or any of these other countries, you won't have a proper economic development, which is produced by capital inflow from investment. But the truth is that there has been some investment going into Uzbekistan recently. We're talking about after 9/11, 2000, in particular 2003, 2004, and this is because the Americans have settled there some military bases. So businessmen have felt protected by the presence of the U.S. Army in Uzbekistan. So there have been investments specifically in oil and gas, but also a little bit in other industries. Now, Uzbekistan is an incredibly wealthy country in terms of resources. He has gold, he has diamonds, he has minerals. So it's a very, very rich country. Now, this pattern, of course, will soon reverse as soon as the Americans will start moving out, which is very likely because just a few days ago, Karimov denied the U.S. to fly over Uzbekistan at night. So he revoked the right of flying at night. And this is in retaliation against the U.S., who actually has suggested that perhaps he should soften a bit its repressive policy towards the population.
That's probably a pretty bad move on his part, since even the Weekly Standard has given up on him now.
Yes.
That's a pretty provocative act. When they were his number one champions in America.
Oh, absolutely. I think the U.S. is turning very quickly because public opinion all over the world is clearly against Karimov. But it is unbelievable that it took 2 months to do that. I mean, the U.S. should have immediately after the upheaval and after the killing of 1,000 people in a square demonstrating in favor of this 23 businessmen in May, the U.S. should have done something, because this is very much like Tiananmen Square. And why did we defend the students in Tiananmen Square and not the population of Uzbekistan?
I have an idea. Maybe it's because the people protesting in Tiananmen Square were communists, and they were protesting against the liberalization of the Chinese economy. So we support them, whereas these people are free marketeers and want the communist government to leave them alone to trade in peace. And so we treat their dictator like a hero against them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes sense, right?
Yes, it does make sense. It does.
Too bad. Truth's stranger than fiction, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it makes sense from the point of view of this irrational politics and policy that the U.S. has been pursuing since the Bush administration came to power.
Help me understand the importance of heroin to the international terrorist rings and their financing.
Well, heroin is very important. Heroin has been important also for the Mujahideen. Let's not forget that in the 1980s, Afghanistan only produced enough poppy for the domestic consumption and just a little bit for export. So the industry was basically non-existent. It was a domestic industry. Now, the CIA, together with the ISI, decided to develop the poppy industry and also the heroin industry, so to refine poppy into heroin, in order to fund the anti-Soviet jihad. And what they did, they brought people from Iran, who actually had been ousted by Khomeini after 1978, who were running the refineries in Iran, into Afghanistan. And these people set up a network of factories where the poppy was actually refined into heroin. Then this heroin was sold predominantly in North America. So the drug route at that time was from Afghanistan to Pakistan, from the ports in Pakistan all the way to North America, so U.S. and Canada.
And what about the Kosovo Liberation Army in that chain?
Well, no, that took place in the 1980s.
Okay.
Then with the end of the anti-Soviet jihad, the route changed. The production of heroin continued to rise, so the industry did not die with the end of the anti-Soviet jihad. It simply changed the route. So because the U.S. was not any longer interested in that trade, the heroin, instead of traveling from Afghanistan to North America, he actually traveled from Afghanistan to Europe. So that's now today, even today, Europe is the most important port of entry for the heroin. Then from Europe goes all over the world. And the drug route, if you look at it, goes through Central Asia, the Caucasus, all the way across northern Iraq, Turkey, and then you get to the Balkans. Along this drug route, we see criminal organizations working together with terrorist organizations, in particular Islamist terrorist organizations. So Chechnya, for example, so the Basayev is very much involved in the transshipment of heroin. The same thing is the Kosovo Liberation Army. But then you see also Ansar al-Islam in North Iraq was very much involved in that business. But then you see in Turkey, the situation is different. In Turkey is the Turkish mafia, which actually carries the drugs across the country, and it's the Turkish mafia that perceived revenues. So it is interesting to see the joint venture between crime and terror related to heroin.
It's also interesting, as you pointed out, the origin of this was the American CIA and the Pakistani ISI encouraged it. They put taxes on poppy, which encouraged, as you say in your book, I think, Afghanistan basically abandoned its agrarian economy entirely in favor of poppies.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, Afghanistan was not at all a country that where only poppy was produced. It was an agrarian country. It had a diversified agricultural system, which was the base of the needs, the agricultural needs of the country. It was the CIA, together with the ISI, they actually boosted that industry. But this is, again, typical of war by proxy, which required vast amounts of money. So one way or another, you've got to find the money. And most of the time, this money comes from criminal activities. It's like the Iran-Contra affairs. You know, the United States sold arms to Iran, its archenemy, in order to get funds for the Contras.
Absolutely. Well, and it also shows that where you create a black market, as you say, the criminal types are going to engage in it. If the West, quote-unquote, were to just legalize heroin, then the price would drop through the floor. It would not be in the interests of terrorists to sell opiates for recreational purposes or whatever to Europeans and Americans to consume.
Yes,
it wouldn't. So it's really having the war against it in the first place is what drives the price up high enough and makes it the kind of business that these underground criminal groups want to participate in.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I've been to many, many conferences organized by organizations which are related to the drug industry, which analyze the drug industry, and everybody that knows the business will tell you that the best way to solve the problem is to legalize drugs, to treat drugs in the same way we're treating tobacco and we're treating alcohol, basically taxing it by legalizing it. And the examples of situations like this, for example, Holland, where with not with heroin, of course, but with marijuana and hashish, but also the example of the Dutch in Indochina, with opium, which was legalized at the time the Dutch were colonized, show that in this situation where the drugs are legal, the demand goes down. So there is less consumption, less consumption for recreational reasons, because of course there will always be consumption for medical reasons. So by legalizing drugs, we would solve the problem of revenues going into terrorist organizations. Let's not forget, drug revenues is number one revenues for armed organizations across the world. And at the same time, we would decrease consumption. But we don't do it for one reason, for the moral issue, because it is considered immoral to say that drugs should be legalized.
Well, and plus our governments want that off-the-books money for their illegal operations as well. They have their own little terrorist groups to fund, don't they?
Yes, of course. I mean, the moment in which you legalize drugs, you block that source of revenue for whenever you need that revenue to be used, as for example in Colombia.
Oh, which that's a can of worms we're not even going to be able to get to today, because when we get back from this break, we need to spend the last 10 minutes talking about Al-Qaeda and how they make their money. It's Loretta Napoleoni, author of Terror Incorporated, on the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Loretta Napoleoni. Her book is Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it to everybody. Very interesting stuff. And of course, we only have about 6 minutes left. In fact, maybe even a little bit less than that. So we won't be able to cover but maybe a tenth of what I have left here to talk with you about. I have another couple of pages worth of notes. Let's talk about Francis Fukuyama and the end of history and the ideas at play there and what that has to do with the current war on terrorism.
Well, what I say, what I do in my book is... Actually, I discuss both Fukuyama and Huntington. Huntington is the clash of civilization, and Fukuyama is the end of history, where he actually says that all countries naturally move towards democracy, and once we reach democracy, then there will be at the end of history, because there won't be any more conflict.
Sort of a Hegelian view with quote-unquote free markets and democracy as the final synthesis.
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting because these are two opposite theories. Because of course, the clash of civilization actually says that we are clashing because we have socio-economic and cultural differences, and these differences push us to fight each other. So one says the end of history, the other says history will continue exactly in the same way. What I try to do in my book, I try to show that actually none of these two theories fits what is happening. What is actually happening is something very similar to the Crusades, the reversal of the Crusades. We have part of the world which has been dominated by another part of the world, and we're talking about the West, but in particular the U.S., with rebelling against this domination, against this hegemony, because they want to get control of their own resources. And this is what is happening also in Uzbekistan. This is what is happening in Iraq.
In fact, you even say that bin Laden is, in fact, I can quote you here, he's not engaged in an ideological dispute. He is extremely pragmatic in all of his arguments.
Yes. Osama bin Laden is extremely pragmatic. He's not at all what we think he is or what we are meant to believe he is. If you look at the way he has constructed Al-Qaeda, but also if you look at his speeches and his writings, he's constantly talking about economics. He's constantly talking about the economic hegemonic power exercised by the West and the oligarchic elites of the Muslim world over the population.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
Well, in your conclusion, you seem to kind of recommend isolating the financing of these groups and sort of waging an economic war against them. I wonder if that isn't just going to cause more of the same. I tend to think that if you really want to destroy your enemies, trade with them and become friends.
Well, what I say in my book is that going to war, going using the war option is actually not going to work, because as we see now in Iraq, the war option has actually increased the popularity of these people. One way to go about is actually to reduce their finances. But in ultimate analysis, the solution can only come by recognizing why they're fighting us and by stopping oppressing them economically and let them, as the case of Uzbekistan, let them do their revolution and establish their own economic system.
Absolutely. That I would tend to agree with that completely. And I'm sorry that we don't have any more time. I got at least another half hour, an hour worth of questions here for you. But we're going to have to call it quits. But everyone, please go and check out Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks by Loretta Napoleone. Her website is LorettaNapoleone.com. That's NapoleoneI. LorettaNapoleone.com. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.